This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 45 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
So, we're here today to do what, Summer?
We are here today to finish season 2 of A Discovery of Witches and to begin the witch draws again, y'all. Because we're not going to have another episode till 2022.
Who are we doing it with? So since we're not incestuous, who are we including?
That's not the reason we're including her. That's just a truth statement. That's just a statement of truth. We were able to coerce Dr. Stephanie McGuckin to come back and join us.
It did not take that much coercion. Come on.
They don't know that.
I am telling them that. Now they know.
She's lying.
I mean, it's not like she was gagging for it. She's just excited.
Summer, do you realize what you just said?
I do. I said that in response to Ginger with her putting things in her mouth and having them feel good.
So it's going to be that kind of episode.
So where are we? We are in 1591 London. Now, this episode, unlike the last episode, is a lot of whiplash. It's a lot of back and forth.
Like, it's pedantic, just a little bit.
I mean, I guess it's an episode of montages, but it's also a lot of back and forth straight up scenes. So 1591, Elizabethan London. Diana is practicing her spell weaving and she's choosing between the threads. And Matthew is working with Jack. Diana has an O seeing them together. Pretty much. Let's be honest.
I wonder if people who draw and or actually sew Celtic knots are looking at this scene and going, that's not how you do that. You know what I mean?
Well, and I think it's also interesting like that they're choosing to use very Celtic knots for almost every single knot.
Yeah. Well, because they're more ornate, right?
Yeah. And it makes sense, but it does kind of crack me up.
Well, Miss Art History person, lady, PhD girl, is there any other? I mean, I know it can't be the only culture who's well known for fancy knots.
Just sailors in general.
I mean, to be fair, there's only so many ways you can tie a knot and to get the number of crossings they need. And even when you think about knot work in other cultures, it looks very similar, even though I think in Western culture and Western art, we're sort of primed to see it as Celtic-y. It's not always that, like, if someone with a different visual background, they're going to see it as something other than Celtic, basically. Whereas I know at least I am trained to see it as Celtic because I work on insular art. But yeah, you get knot work in pretty much any artistic culture.
It just makes me think of, you know, sailors and making knots and Boy Scouts learning knots. Like, this is a lost.
Summer just has one particular sailor on her brain.
This is a lost art, man. It's not lost. People still do it, but it's not something you think about. It's something most people think about. Like my dad, like if we're moving somewhere and we're putting something in the back seat, not the back seat, the back of his truck, he's always got to tie it down and he's got a special type of knot that he uses. And I'm like, what? He's never taught me. I've never asked because I don't need to because he knows them, right? Because I never ask. Why would I ask? Someone else will do it. So it's like, it's just something that you don't think about until you need to think about it. And I rarely need to think about it.
And the music that is going on, yes, being played when Diana has her O seeing Matthew and Jack together is like, it's a very cozy sounding music, like homey.
Did you just say she had an O? Are you implying that she's having an orgasm looking at Matthew?
That was the second time. Yeah, you missed the first one.
I'm just saying that was a real delicate orgasm. That was like an orgasm that...
My point was she's having an O watching Matthew work with Jack. It makes her very happy.
That is the gentlest O I've ever seen in my life.
Fair enough.
It reminds me, but saying that reminds me, did you guys ever see Amelie? I mean, there's a compilation in the very front end of the movie of her imagining that so many different people across France or whatever are all having orgasms right now. And it's all these different types of orgasms. And the very last one is a girl going, ah, and that was it. Okay. So I think that that's her, ah.
In another sense here, other than just orgasm, we know how much this means to Matthew to be a father again. And yeah, and I think the really interesting and kind of sweet thing about these opening scenes, which are really a montage, and we can talk about that in a minute, but is this back and forth of Diana finishing her knot work, which was the whole point of them going back. And the accident here is they've adopted Jack. And so there's this really sort of interesting, to my mind, juxtaposition of Diana doing what she's supposed to be doing and Matthew accidentally becoming a father again to Jack, and a sense of like denial and struggle between what is going to ultimately win out.
But also, how bittersweet is it that he's really just practicing on Jack for his own kid who's growing inside of his wife right now? He's just practicing. He doesn't plan to keep him.
Yeah.
That's like renting an animal from a foster place, or like saying, I want to adopt this animal, and going down to the shelter, keeping it for a weekend and being like, that was cool, I'm done now, and giving it back.
Something to keep in mind about this season, season two, is yes, they're adaptations, and thus they cannot have all of the themes and all of the things, all of the scenes from books. We get it. But something that I think is even stronger in season two is that Diana. Yeah, because we talked to her. Deb has told us in interviews, she's told the world, it's not a secret. She has said that the theme, one of the overall strong themes, through lines of book one is mothers. And the line, theme, through line, whatever, of book two is fathers. Now we can see that especially in the latter half of the season. You see that with Matthew and Jack, Matthew and his, you know, impending fatherhood. We see that with Matthew saying with Philippe and Philippe's presence everywhere. We see it with Matthew having to say goodbye to Philippe. We see it with, later in this episode, we have another father who appears, right? And I have to say goodbye to that father and all these things. It is literally, and I'm going to like spoil y'all for myself, not that it matters, but almost different circumstances, absolutely. But the same way that Diana says goodbye to her father, it's a very similar, it's almost like a mirror of Matthew and Philippe, almost a mirror. So this season does it very well, even though that may not have been a theme of the show, right? They actually, at least in the latter half of the season, they do a really good job of portraying this theme of fathers. I did not get a theme of, I mean, other than the fact that her mother and father were there, I don't remember feeling the same way about season one and mothers.
Well, that's because we really only saw Rebecca very briefly. Like I feel like we saw Stephen last season more than we saw Rebecca.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's not just like the amount that we get. I mean, she's a mother. We do have Sophie, who's about to become a mother. We have Isabeau, who is Matthew's.
Agatha.
Yeah. So there are mothers. But what I'm saying is, just because you have them doesn't mean the theme is being driven home. Here we have, there were fathers in season one.
And we have to say goodbye to every single one of them in this season.
Yeah. Well, and I think the thing is, when comparing that is season one, you have the mothers and it's a lack of mothers around Diana, whereas the fathers in this are specifically related to Diana and her arc. And I think, like Summer was saying, because we say goodbye to the fathers in season two, the theme is just a bit closer to the surface. Whereas I can see retroactively going back through season one, you could talk about the mothers and how the mothers are just there in season one compared to how Diana has nothing.
But it's literal. It's so literal this season. You know what I mean? It's so literal. And it's like resolving daddy issues. That's the season, resolving daddy issues.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. It's resolving them. And that's why it's so present. Whereas there are sort of mommy issues in the same way in season one to resolve. The mothers are just these strong background figures. And that includes the aunts to some extent, although there are issues there, certainly.
So do we think, is there significance to the constellations or is it just?
That's interesting. Yeah. So we're just about to get there. So there's a little more spell work she does. And then we see, yeah, definitely a montage. And then we see a scene where they're looking up at the night sky. There's stargazing in London. And Diana says, now that's magic.
Can we just that moment? Come on. Now that's magic.
Earlier when I said when she looks on and sees, has a small O, looking on at Matthew with Jack, there's cozy, homey music behind it. But the music that ends the montage when she says that's magic, looking at stargazing in London, that has a much more sad sound to it.
Well, for reasons. It's because she feels the end is nigh. As she's learning more knots and becoming more knowledgeable, she is sensing their time being briefer and briefer. And knowing that makes everything that they're doing more important and more bittersweet.
And then the line, a knot about completion is never easy. So she is with Goody Alsup and she's working on her knots. And she gets it, she loses it. And it just dissolves. So she's having a hard time. Or is she unconsciously blocking it because she doesn't want to leave? It's probably a little bit of both.
I think that's going to come later. But we notice now that they can meet without the reed. So why did they need the reed all the other times?
Maybe she needed more support.
How much of it is that you need the reed to do, to sort of contain the magic in case it goes wrong? Especially at the very beginning when Diana is not confident. She's not there yet to do some of it. So now they feel like it's not going to go as wrong. But how much of this is also secret knowledge? Like, it's one thing for them to see the force spell and to see through seven, not seven, but are 8, 9, 10, and especially 10, because even Goody herself doesn't have that one mastered, as we find out later. How much of that is like the other witches aren't allowed to see the weaver's practice?
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought that, but that's interesting.
It's true, but they let her do all of those knots in front of all the non-weavers the whole time.
Up till seven, only seven.
So you think seven is the...
No, I'm saying only seven that were shown. She could have done eight, who knows, but she's doing nine right now. We know nine is at least the cutoff.
Is there some sort of higher level magic that's being evoked here, but not named as such, that the weavers keep to themselves? Or is it simply because Diana has more control? Or is it that the other actresses were busy?
They were busy.
Budget cuts, y'all. Fire Drake, fire chicken.
As she's not able to do this knot, and Goody Alsop says it's never easy, there are two low note beats. Now the music here sounds ominous, and then the theme sounds, and then we get Goody Alsop saying, as if she heard something or felt something, which she has, that another weaver has arrived in London. And so I took those notes about the ominous sound, you know, ominous notes, low notes, that came before the nice sound of the theme. But that ominous feeling that we kind of get, the spooky feeling that we go, oh, it's another weaver, better watch out, hence the low note. So absolutely, the low notes absolutely anticipated. So Rob Lane completely anticipated that, so, which is perfect, right? That's his job, to like to tell the story through the music. And here he hinted at it before the lines got there. And then we're at the Pyrex opening. The episode proper opens up at Sept Tour in France, present time. We see Sophie, Nathaniel, Agatha, and the baby have all arrived safely. Meanwhile,
In a minivan.
Meanwhile, Marcus and Phoebe are driving to Sept Tour too. Tour. Try saying that.
Did it throw? Okay, I know they're in France. I know they're in France, and I know that on France they drive on the right side of the road. But it was super weird to see this show have someone have one Phoebe drive. No, yeah, Phoebe driving and driving on what is an American car. Sorry, what I would call an American car, but obviously that's a French car too. But to have the driver be on the left hand side on this series was so mentally jarring for me. I was like, what? Why is she's on the wrong side of the car?
So after they arrive, they come in and she meets Isabeau, and Isabeau says the place as regarding everyone, like all the people coming in. She's like, the place feels alive again, and Mott loves it.
Here's what I think about every time I see Phoebe in this episode being introduced to Sept Tour as she is. Because imagine Diana's delight at finding all of the old books when she goes back to Elizabethan London, right? This is the same feeling that Phoebe is having right now going into Sept Tour and seeing all of these well-preserved antiques.
So are you saying that Phoebe is now having an O?
Oh God, yeah.
Then we're slapped back into 1591. Walk in the streets. Diana wants to get Jack a book. She's with Matthew. And Matthew says, I smell coffee. It's a time walker. right? He's like, it's a time walker. It's the weaver they'd been warned about. Who's it? What's it? Well, things are starting to slowly fall in place, or maybe become less clear. It is her daddy.
Dad?
Before we get to dad, can we just talk about the fact that they're in basically a market?
Mm-hmm.
And the stall owner of the market is within earshot, and they're just casually throwing out the future stuff. So going back to what we were talking about in 209 with the like changing and like throwing it out, they're just like, there's coffee, but it can't be. That's in a few hundred years. And I feel bad for the poor like extra sporting guy that's just off screen just being like, do I react to that? Like, it just cracks me up because there's no censor. There's no filter. There's nothing.
They have to fake it.
And I'm like, you cannot just be throwing that information out there, guys. At least like attempt to like lean over and whisper, but that's not yet. Don't just shout it. Like, don't just make this grand announcement about the future.
The choices of when they do and don't care are just crazy, because you're like, do we care or don't we care? Because today we don't care. We don't care today. It's coffee.
Today's a not care.
But they get called out for it later. And that's what I like. Like jumping ahead just a little bit. Like when her dad is like, y'all have been here too long. Stop it. You can just kind of feel him going into dad mode, and I wish he'd been there like 3 episodes ago to just like smack them on the head.
Well, because in the timeline of the actual book, it should have happened way sooner in the episode.
Right.
Like, that's the slap in the head that makes them get into gear, that makes them realize they've gone native.
Yeah.
And the problem with going native is that you start becoming complacent. You stop remembering that you're on a path and your goal is something much larger than you are currently doing. Because right now you're paying attention to the minutiae of the day to day. And you're worrying about this child who you can't take with you, who you can't really care for past this moment. And when Diana herself even said in the last episode, I could see myself staying here.
Yeah, that's danger. That's dangerous talk. And also basically Diana, I mean, I guess kind of Matthew too, but at least Matthew is kind of is a little more on top of things than Diana. But as far as, you know, we got to go. But Matthew is enjoying himself too, right? And they need a project manager to keep them on task and to keep them on schedule. And that is Stephen. So yes, her dad is the witch weaver, time spinner.
Self-taught, mind you. Self-taught.
Yes. That's crazy town who has arrived. They're like, oh my gosh, you're here. Ah. So they have a little, you know, who's he, what's it, whatever. But her dad says to them, you were riding a tricycle 2 days ago. That's a huge freaking clue. And they just, I'm not saying they jump over it, but there's like no beat given to that. There's no beat given to that. And so if you're a reader, you don't really need the beat. But if you are a viewer, like, you know that he's out of his own time, just like they are, right? Like, that's not a surprise. However, and you know he's dead from season one. Fair enough. But saying you were riding a tricycle 2 days ago, it is a huge, not a flag, it's a huge reminder that he has knowledge of Diana before she does, right? And before, obviously, before he dies. Her parents were killed when she was, what, 7 or 8?
Tricycles are much younger. She should be on a real bike by now.
He was killed. They were killed when she was 7 or 8, approximately. If she were on a tricycle 2 days ago, which means may as well mean now, or in the current timeline he's from.
Mm-hmm.
That means she was between 3 and 5, maybe, right? Maybe 3 and 6.
God, I would hope not.
Maybe an 8-year-old could be on a tricycle. I don't know. I'm not judging. But typically, it's going to be quite a young child.
A lot. I mean, unless it's like a, you know, they have those tricycles for adults. I want one so bad because I'm terrible at riding a bike. I'm good at it, but I always fall. So I would love a tricycle, but I don't think it's that kind of tricycle. I think we're closer to, like, you know, old school.
Like the tiny ones. Yeah. So the reason I bring this up is not because it changes the story. No. But it just, I'm kind of surprised the show doesn't give us a beat. They just go on, right? They go on with the dialogue. They go, and which is fine. But,
well, I mean, we know that his coming back into the past, and we find out why he's there at this point in time, was not uncommon. He did it a lot.
Yeah.
So it's not, he's not there as a sense of urgency.
Correct. That's a good point. That's a good point to make, because I don't know that it's obvious to the viewer only, like the non-reader. I don't know that it's obvious to the non-reader that he does this a lot.
They said it in the first season when they found that box that they were like, this is pristine.
Okay.
This is something from such and such era. I've never seen one in this condition. And they're like, oh, time walker.
So, okay. So there's that. So those are hints to pick up on. But something here, a hint, I think probably the only hint, at least in this season or this episode that we get to pick up on that he does it a lot, is that he has a routine, right? Or he knows he has something. He does it enough to know that they've been here too long. He does it enough to know these rules, even if they're his rules, or maybe the unwritten time walker, time spinner rules. Like, you go in, you do the thing, and you leave. You go in, you do the thing, and you leave. Now, he's taking stuff with him, which might be a little bit not following the rules. But outside of that, yeah, it could be evidence that he's at least done it a lot. But yeah, so the only real kind of evidence, maybe indirect evidence, that we get that he has done this a lot is that he is so strict with those rules because he follows them and he knows what can happen. So that's just what they needed. Like, yeah, they could have used it a little earlier, but that's what they needed. So him saying you were riding a tricycle 2 days ago puts us in his timeline, right? Not hers, in his. So his timeline is 3 to 5, depending on her age, 3 to 5 years before she dies. So the last 3 to 5 years of his life, approximately. But he also shares that Rebecca had seen a vampire in her vision. And so, or he says basically, this must, because she introduces them, right? This is Matthew. And he says, this must be the vampire that Rebecca has seen in her visions. And so her father knew, right? And the aunts know this.
I mean, can we just talk about the one-upmanship of that marriage? She's like, I had a vision that our daughter is going to be with a vampire. And him like, oh yeah? Well, I just went back in time and I met that motherfucker.
I met the vampire.
And I know his name. His name is Matthew de Clermont.
I met the damn dude.
And I guess what else? I got to see our adult daughter. Everything we do works. works, bitch.
I wonder if he told Rebecca. Oh, man. In comes Jack. Stephen, that's what causes Stephen to ask, like, how long has he been with you? And the ominous music starts again. The ominous music starts again. So Stephen then lays out his reason for being there. He is there to look for Ashmole 782. So Stephanie and Summer too, but Stephanie most likely, again, Summer may know. So we remember book and show in season one when she comes out of the Bodleian, like after the whole book fiasco,
because it was after
she runs into her dad.
Wasn't he? She runs by him going in, and she, because she's on her way out.
She sees him really quickly. So, you know, that's a good question. That's a good question, because if it were, that's true, because they can't time walk. Well, I don't know. Can they time walk to the future?
I don't think you can. No, it has to be someplace you've been. You have to have seen it and know it.
No, that's not true, because Stephen's timeline does not involve 16th century London. So that's not true.
You can go back because it exists, but you can't go forward because you can't envision what you're doing and you can't have things from the future.
That's different from saying you had to have been there.
They needed three things. Okay.
Okay.
I'm remembering. You need three things from that place you're trying to go. And you can't have three things from the future unless somebody else brought them to you.
So yeah, I think it had to be an echo, because for her to see him in, like, legit see him and it not being an echo of him there means he would have had to travel to the future, right? Which doesn't happen. So yeah, it had to be an echo. So that kind of answered that question. Never mind. That's done.
But it could have been exactly an echo of him depositing the book into, or looking for the book, or spelling the book.
Yeah, okay, that's where I was going. Do we think that he did something to the book, even though obviously it's in their care right now, right? We don't know what we don't know. They could have shown it to him off scene.
They would have had to have been off scene because they didn't show it to him on screen.
Obviously. But what I'm saying is, do we think that he did something? He did his little magic, right? He set that spell. Do we think he set that spell for Diana in the past, in this past, or he did it at some point in the future?
I think he does at some point in the future. And we know that he sees the book at some point in the future, like in his life, because he specifically says,
because he writes in it.
Well, not just that he writes in it, but he specifically says in this episode, I was hoping to see it like whole. Like, he goes back to study it before it's been damaged. So he didn't go back far enough, because Diana and Matthew have already ensured that it is messed up. There's that element of it, that he's back to see it before it's damaged, hopefully so that he can leave clues, because he also admits that they have that other folio already that's been sent to them. So he's trying to piece together the manuscript, I think, in the past, or at least see it in its context, like Diana's trying to do. So yeah, I think there's that travel, and we know that he's written in it.
Yeah, when he says that, I wanted to see it. I'm like, yes, same, bro. So do they. And you're like months too late. If you'd shown up months ago and met us in Prague, or not Prague, you would have been able to maybe have a glimpse of it like we did before dude ripped it out.
Yeah, and which is just so annoying. Oh, speaking of the ripping, everyone is like freaking out about how she says that it's a straight edge. And
she does.
Do you, like, honestly, just stop and think about it, guys. The manuscript has clearly been rebound. So when they rebound the manuscript, they probably just straightened that edge, which is common practice. And so every time someone's like, well, how did this happen? I'm like, the easy answer is the manuscript has been rebound, which is very clear between how we've seen the manuscript in season one to season two.
Don't you Occam's razor me. Don't you Occam's razor me.
Like, the manuscript has been rebound. Like, clearly. I'm just like, guys, stop. Think about the visuals. This is what's happened.
I don't like that answer.
But it's true.
I like to imagine that he's a master terror and is amazing at ripping things with straight edge precision.
I mean, it could be that, but chances are that it's got undergone conservation, because this manuscript has clearly come to the attention of several people in its history.
Do you think Dee did it when it was in his? Because he rebounded, didn't he? Because he named it Ashmole 782.
That would have been when it was donated.
No, because it ended up in the collection of someone named Isaac Ashmole. And the books, when someone dies or gives away or bequeaths their a collection of something, they name it after that.
Often, yeah, when it's put into the institution. So when it was rebound as Ashmole 782, which is how we see it in season one, that could have been the moment that the edges were cleaned or straightened, or it could have been bound before, because we only see two versions of the binding,
the red and then the brown.
So the 1590s and then the current. So it could have been rebound before that. We just don't know. We don't know the complete provenance of the manuscript.
Because it's not real. I mean, it is real, but it's not real.
So they all chat, and she says,
"Awkward conversations with my father." That's what this should be called. Awkward conversations with my father.
She shares that the book now, well, no, never. The book still won't let her read it. And she mentions the pages ripped out, and she describes it. They talk about how there was a page sent to Diana. It was postmarked from Jerusalem.
Rabbi Lowe.
So, and they think, was it Jewish witches? And then they say maybe Rabbi Lowe. So just to straighten my brain out, when they mention this page sent to Diana, is it sent to Diana in the future?
It's sent to Stephen and
Rebecca.
Thank you. I was like, what's her name? I kept trying to say Diana, but that's not what I meant.
So now that makes me wonder if Stephen had contact with those Jewish witches in the past.
Well, that's the whole question, is because Diana is like, oh, it must have been Rabbi Lowe that sent it. And so that's their assumption. But we don't know that for sure, I don't think.
So who has the pages? Kelly had them, right?
Kelly had them. And then I would assume Fuchs had them, had at least touched some of them, because he took Kelly.
Oh, because he went to grab him. Got it.
Is Fuchs yet looking for this manuscript?
No, he doesn't want the manuscript. From what I understand, okay, I've been listening to Book of Life again. He doesn't give, from what I can read, I don't think he cares a tick about this book.
He does have one main focus goal, and it's maybe book adjacent. Maybe not book is the target, but the book is involved or has information.
That was going to be my next thing, was I don't see Fuchs willingly surrendering anything that can be used in his ultimate goal. And it is quite clear that Matthew has been looking for this book for decades before Diana comes into this picture, if not centuries. If Fuchs had any reason to suspect that those folios could be used in his ultimate goal, then I don't think he would have done it. And I also don't think Fuchs is the one that's sending them to the three creatures.
Oh, of course not, because Fuchs would never let it go.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
Right. So I think the folios, there's something else that's happened to them. And I think it is Rabbi Lowe that gets them or has them.
It would make sense because he's there. He has, maybe it's difficult, but he has the opportunity.
This is all off book anyway, even if it does happen. Do we think that then before Fuchs liberates Kelly, that Kelly and Lowe have some sort of interaction wherein you think Lowe is the one who sends them to everyone, is like the disseminator?
I think at some point, because it has to be, because Stephen clearly says it came
from Jerusalem. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the postmark. So
no, he said Jewish witches.
Yeah.
Right.
But the implication then is that it's coming from someone coming from Rabbi Lowe or someone.
Lowe was involved back in his day, or in this day. However he got them, right? We don't know how, but.
Well, and he was on his way out of Not Prague.
Yes.
Because he was being kicked out of Not Prague.
But we don't know I guess if it's during Diana's own actual real timeline, that it would have been during Stephen's timeline, because he knows about it, right? They got them. So if they showed up in that timeline, it means they made it to Jerusalem at some point and were held in safety. So Rabbi Lowe, if he's the way they got there, would have then got, because he obviously knows all about creatures, right? He would have gotten in touch with the local witch pop in Jerusalem and said, here, take this, guard this.
And the thing is, and this is something that I think Rabbi Lowe, there's a lot of mistreatment of this character in a lot of different ways. And one of the things that isn't as clear in the show is that Rabbi Lowe doesn't just know creatures. He is friendly with a lot of the creatures generally, and from each sort of type or sect of creatures. Yeah.
And he's like a mystic as well. Like, he creates a golem, y'all.
There's another weaver that creates the golem. Rabbi Lowe's protecting the weaver that created the golem.
Yes.
In the books, and introduces Diana to this person who we don't have any hint of in the show, which is fine, whatever. We don't need the golem subplot. But we need the knowledge that Lowe is friends with witches, specifically weavers, demons, it's implied. And then and he knows vampires. He clearly knows Matthew and Philippe, but he also knows Fuchs, because there's that whole really interesting scene in the books where it's Lowe, Fuchs, and Diana. And I missed that scene and that dynamic in the show. But I think knowing all of that explains sort of how Lowe would have been positioned to ensure that at some point, roughly within Diana's lifetime, that Jewish witches would have been able to send this manuscript, because Lo knows that they're not quite the right time, right? So it's like Philippe, that you keep an eye out and you sort of calculate, okay, well, she was probably about this old in this period, so I can guesstimate when she comes from, even if I don't know for sure. So when certain things start happening, those witches would have been sort of trained to go, oh, okay, this is now the time that we need to mail these things off. But this also brings, side note here again, this brings me to the question of the demon that ends up with the demon folio, right? Who we've only seen hints of in season one. Who was his family to have been the one to get this?
Well, and plus, demons aren't guaranteed to beget demons. They're kind of, they pop out of nowhere.
And that's really interesting, because he does say it's his grandfather, and it's very clear in Book of Life that he is related to the demon who gave the flesh for this folio or something, because it's really, there's a lot there to unpack, which we can do that when we get to Book of Life. But my point is, how is that folio connected here, and how has it been passed down? Because maybe it's not his grandfather, maybe it's just the legacy of the grandfather. That's not the implication. But anyway, how,
maybe it's Maybelline.
What's gone on there for that demon folio to be passed down in the same way that it has for the other creature folios?
There's a lot to find out, and we will hopefully find out. So as they're talking about the book and the pages with Stephen, Diana says many people are looking for it, including Peter Knox. And her dad, Stephen, is like, oh, Peter is obsessed with the dark arts. So we get, not that we didn't think that, but now we're getting a little more confirmation, and not just confirmation that Knox is a bad dude, but that Stephen knows Knox is a bad dude, right? Not just like, he liked my wife, he wanted her, but no, he's like legit bad dude.
Well, he was obsessed.
Obsessed.
Venice present. So Gerbert and Knox are chatting, and they're like, look, the priority has to be these missing pages, because yeah, I know we don't have the book, but with the pages, once we do get the book, we got it, yo.
Well, it's not just that. It's like, it's if we have the pages, we have leverage. And right now they have nothing. They have the idea of leverage, but they can't really make anyone do anything is the problem with, they are feeling impotent in this endeavor. Like they want to be larger players in this, but it seems like all of the pieces are nowhere near them, and they want to get their hands on them so badly.
Isabeau, we learn, refuses to cooperate, and they wonder, do Diana's aunts have the witch's page? And Gerbert thinks that they're at Setour, the aunts and the pages. And he says, it would take, buttering up, Knox, of course, it would take a powerful witch to get close. And Knox is like, I'm not your hunting dog. And he says, fetch.
So good, fetch.
Gerbert has like the best one-liners.
He's had a lot of time to practice those one-liners and to collect impressive socks, which references his past.
That's true. I wouldn't want to get into a war of words. The witches may be more powerful, right?
Or socks.
I wouldn't want to get into a war of words with a vamp, a long-lived vamp, because they've just had time and nothing else. They may not be smarter than you as naturally, like, you know, they may not come to it naturally, but you give someone 1,000 years, they're going to be smarter than you if they read and learn and all that crap. Okay, 1591 London, Elizabethan London. Stephen admonishes Matthew. He's like, you guys have stayed too long. And Diana admits, yes, we screwed up. And he's like, you need to observe, not participate. You need to go and you need to leave the book behind. He was like, I was going to study the book in this time. I wasn't going to take it. And Diana's like, nope, because she wants to take it. But Stephen says, no, you've already messed with history. The book stays.
Can you imagine being chastised by someone your own age at this degree and having the sheer volume of balls to talk to a 500, 600, however long-lived Matthew is, like he's a child? Because he is. He's treating them both like they're children, and they're taking it because of respect, I'm sure, and because he is still her father. But I can't imagine like somebody on my level at work coming at me and talking to me like that at all.
But the thing that's so, wonderful about that interaction is Stephen is acting like Matthew is his teenage daughter's boyfriend, and he treats him as such. And there's this mutual respect and I think recognition of power. And because Matthew has suddenly, because of Diana, come to respect the power of witches and of weavers in particular, he sees Stephen in a different light than he would have if they had, you know, met under normal circumstances. There's that respect, but there's also this sort of, well, I can't can't argue with him because my wife doesn't know her father. And I know how much getting that second chance with my father was. So I'm just going to let him have it. Because there's that element of this scene too, is that healing aspect. And of all of their interactions with Stephen, that second chance to get to know him and to get to know him as an adult, that I think is just quite beautiful for both Diana and Matthew.
But it's so fleeting. And, you know, I feel like he did a better goodbye in the series than he did in the book. But he like literally dipped, man. He dipped hard. He's like, I think it's time for a stroll. I know we're not there yet.
Yeah, but that was effective. I understand why. Because he doesn't want, the more he does touchy-feely stuff, the more to me, it was more effective. I love that he took more time in the series. Don't get me wrong. But it made it that much more tragic and thus effective. And I don't just mean because it was in the feels. I just mean he was actually, he practices what he preaches, right? He doesn't take stuff. Well, except when he does. He doesn't mess with history, except when he does. But he's definitely more on the straight and narrow than they are as far as affecting history, right? He doesn't stay too long. In the book, it was a similar, you know, similar admonition, similar conversation. But yeah, he's like, okay, well, I think it's time for me to go. Hug, toodles, and like he leaves, right? It's not drawn out. And I think in the book, and I could be wrong, I think in the book here too, because he's obviously not dead because he's still traveling, but he says somewhere here, I think I already said it, or maybe I say it a little bit later. It's not, I have a note somewhere in here that their goodbye, which we're not at yet, but their goodbye is a mirror of Matthew's goodbye to Philippe, right? Not identical, no, but it's similar. It's very similar. It's a father figure, and it's someone that you're saying goodbye to, and you know they're going to be dead in your time, and you can't say anything. That's the mirror. That's a heck of a lot of similarities here. In the book, though, I think the show did an amazing job at adapting the book version of the Matthew Philippe, okay? I think the show did a great job. I love what they did with Diana Stephen, but I think they made it mirror Philippe's more rather than keeping to the book.
There is this element of them mirroring for sure, and that's very obvious to me throughout all of these interactions. But there's also the simple fact that by choosing to have this interaction in the last episode, they have to change it. He can't just duck. It wouldn't work. I think in a way they set themselves up where they had to do something to make this more fulfilling for the viewer. And I think the mirroring is the answer in the adaptation there, which again, this is one of those times where I think the adaptation choices that they've made work for what they've done, but do sort of make you realize the other adaptation choices that don't work.
Or that might work in that we love them, but we lost something because of them. And we don't know what we lost because we didn't get it. Or maybe don't know everything that we lost. So yeah, so he admonishes them. You guys have, like, it's been too long. You guys got to go. The book's got to stay. And present day set tour. They're discussing this whole thing, right? Between Agatha, Isabeau, all the people who are there now. They're talking about what's going on. And they're saying Peter Knox is getting out of hand. The congregation, ultimately, if it gets worse, they're going to start forced segregation of the species again. Marcus says the only way we can all be safe is to rescind the covenant. And Phoebe, little human Phoebe, is saying, you know, isn't the fact that we're all together, doesn't that mean that things have already changed? Of course. She's just bringing it to the obvious light. And she says the only way forward is together. She's like, humans got a lot of crap that they do, but they're definitely, look at them. They have actually done better than us as far as surviving and adapting. So we need to go forward together, not only as species, but with humans. You know, maybe not open up to them right away, but, you know, we have to go forward. We need to be together. Later, Phoebe is caught in Isabeau's space. And this is what you guys were talking about earlier. She had an O as soon as she stepped into the castle. That's not a secret. Like, oh, can I please like see this? Can I snoop? I'm so sorry. Isabeau's like, snoop away. Go for it.
She's excited to meet Marcus's mom, right? Or grandmother. But at the same time, she's like, but look at that table. Look at that chair. Blah!
And this is the line I was trying to remember, which I just wrote like two lines later. So Phoebe reminds them, humans can do great things, but their capacity to hate is bonker town.
So the thing I love about this whole like arc and this thing is how accepting of everything that Phoebe is saying Isabeau is. Because she is there for it. She's like, yes, snoop away. You know, she tells Marcus that she's right. And it's just night and day to how she treated Diana as well. It's almost because Phoebe recognizes the way that Isabeau has curated the house.
Oh, she respects it. Yeah, she walks in. She's like, oh, you know taste.
Yeah, and it's not just that, but she's admiring stuff of Philippe's. So she's automatically just in Isabeau's good graces. And then I think because of everything that Isabeau has seen with Matthew and Diana, and of course the witches and the demons staying under her roof, she's just sort of like, I need someone that reminds me of Philippe. And that happens to be Phoebe here. And I just love it. I think it's such a beautiful moment.
I think that the other thing to consider is that Isabeau doesn't leave her house ever. She really only associates with other vampires. She, until Diana, detested witches, and literally demons are beneath her. She has no time for them. However, humans, she was once human, and Matthew was once human. So I think that there's always more potential in humans than there is in the other species. So I think that she's definitely more open to Phoebe just based on that, because she's like, you're not already a member of some group that I detest or don't trust or don't care about. She sees potential because she could become something else, because humanity is, for them, is only a stepping point.
Back in London town, in Elizabethan London, Galaglass arrives, and Matthew says, this Matthew Royden is coming to an end. Diana and I must go back. We need to tie up loose ends, but ta-da, you'll get the old me back. And Gigi's all, sorry, Summer. Gigi's all, yeah, I think I like the new you better. I only got to wait 500 years.
I want to go back. You skipped over this, and I found it really poignant. The scene, Isabeau and I believe Marcus, is that they have a very small conversation about Philippe. And she says, grief carves a place in the heart. Sadness becomes resolve and pain becomes action. And there's more to it than that. But it's just, it was such a moving statement. And for me, it resonated really deeply. But it was like, grief never ends. It just changes. And it becomes something that you use to power other things, or something that helps you to move on, you know, but it never goes away. And it's this beautiful moment for Isabeau in speaking about how, you know, she's never stopped loving Philippe, and she's never stopped grieving his loss. But his loss has channeled all of that feeling and that pain and that energy into doing something productive, which is moving forward with her family and supporting everything the way that it is and trying to make things better. And she told Marcus he chose well.
Let's back up. So yes, Isabeau, she's chatting with Marcus. And as Summer said, she tells him, you made an excellent choice in Phoebe. And you're right, we need to adapt. And she says, Philippe did this. That was what he was so good at. He believed in hope for all creatures. And then, as Summer said, she speaks of her grief. She says, that's what grief can be used. I don't want to say the weapon. It could be a weapon too. But grief can be harnessed and used for it for many things.
Do you think she thinks he made a good choice because they needed an art historian in the family?
I mean, that's probably part of it.
No, they do. They desperately do if they've got Holbeins in the toilet. But the thing that, again, I think Isabeau recognizes something of Philippe in Phoebe. Whether it's that potential, that hope, that desire for change in a way that benefits everyone, there's something there that she just sees Philippe, and she sees potential. And I think that's what it is. And I think she's got a soft spot for Marcus as well. I think it's all of these things. But like, if Isabeau has a favorite grandchild, you know it's Marcus. Like, you know it's him. And so like, Marcus brings a girlfriend home, like, she's gonna like her, especially once she starts complimenting her things.
So then we're in London. And Galaglass arrives, Matthew Royden is coming to an end, Diana and Matthew must go back to tie up loose ends, but ta-da, you're gonna get the old me back, ha-ha! And Galaglass says, yeah, I think I like the this you, the modern, the future Royden, the this you. It is the this you, the you in front of me. But yeah, he's only gotta wait about 500 years to have this nicer dude back.
You know, the more we find out about people in the past knowing Matthew and interacting with current Matthew, the more of a past Matthew becomes. Like, he must have been like royally just an a-hole.
You know that, like, all of these people that have interacted with like future Matthew in the past, that like when past Matthew sort of reappears and does something particularly foolish, that they're all sort of behind him like, yeah, you're gonna get it in the future. Like, there's almost a sense that they're holding something over him and they're giggling behind his back about exactly how much trouble he gets into himself.
Wait, they totally are.
Right?
Heck, even Queen Elizabeth I is going to hold crap over him for the little bit of time that the Royden shows back.
The Royden. That's like a hemorrhoid. The Royden.
But like, I kind of imagine like Philippe just like really annoyed at Matthew and looking at Francoise or someone and just being like, I can't wait for Diana to straighten this idiot out. Like, you
know that happened.
Oh, yeah. It's all the people who have to be sworn to secrecy. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah, Stephen and Diana go for a walk. They're talking not. And he asks her about her desire. Interesting with, you know, absence and desire. He says, if you complete it, that you're not. You have to go. Like, basically, okay, you have just enough time to do that. As soon as that's done, it's no joke, girl. You got to go. She agrees. She introduces him to Goody Alsup. And her dad tells Diana, as she's trying with the knots, he says, stop trying so hard. And she gets the knot of nine. With knot of nine, the spell be mine. So she's almost there. She's getting number nine. She's getting kind of 90. And then Stephen says, quote, some witches would kill for that kind of power. Just a little.
Spoiler alert.
And then I wrote, someone let the air out of the balloon. There's a pause there. We get sad music, sad-ish sounding music. And you can see in her face, yeah, she's going to miss him, but she wants to tell him so much and she can't. She is terrified of changing anything, but she wants to change everything. He gets the gist. You don't see it or hear it because he does not say the words, but he gets the gist because what he says reflects that. Nothing can keep, I'm going to tingle, nose tingle. Nothing can keep your mom and me from our fate, Diana. Our time with you is short. Make peace with it, honey. It's part of the whole tapestry, like your child to come. So Rebecca had seen that she would be pregnant, that she would have a child. So that's anything to do with Stephen, anything to do with basically daddies. I guess I'm a daddy girl. Whew. This book two is my favorite. Season two has quickly become my favorite. And
so were they doing this knot weaving in the courtyard, like a public courtyard?
I think it's the courtyard of their house.
Okay, because Matthew was standing up on the walkway.
Yeah.
And usually that same walkway had a lot of traffic.
Yep.
So I'm concerned that they're literally standing in this, what looks like the place that had lots of foot traffic previously, doing their magic spells.
Yeah, it makes sense, though, because not the outside part, but it makes sense that Stephen is, of course, allowed to be part of that, right? He's a weaver. He's a witch.
No, I don't mind that he's part of it. I'm saying it looked like they were standing in the middle of the street.
Well, I think they're in a private courtyard, but the door to the street is certainly open because at the end of the scene, when Goody's leaving, she's like, peace, and just walks out that way. So, yeah, there is some privacy concern there.
So that whole scene was actually super quick, right? And now he wants to peace out. And the music gets a little ominous. This goodbye, I imagine, is hard too. And this is the first time I wrote lots of parallel here between Matthew's goodbye with Philippe and her goodbye with Stephen. I'll have to go back and listen to the music. I think they even use the same music, Rob Lane.
He's not listening to this.
It doesn't matter. I'm just kind of accusatory. Like, of course you do something like that, Rob Lane. So Diana gets a taste now of how hard it is to leave a life, or not even how hard it is, but how it is to leave a life behind. And this is something that vampires have always had to do. And they're back at home, and Matthew says that Henry Percy will be looking after Jack. Matthew promises her he'll be looked after. But is that enough for Diana?
Maybe we'll find out soon.
Gallowglass wants to accompany her to their destination, but because she wants to go somewhere. And she's like, no, thank you. I'm going to go. It's all good. I'm going to go see Goody Alsup. We'll be fine.
And no one's surprised that they're meeting in a location that they've never met the coven before. I don't think we've ever been there. Have we?
Yeah, we have. We've seen that.
Is that the first place they meet the Reed?
The very first season. Yeah. And it's also the place where the bonfire.
Oh, yeah.
That's outside of that, I believe. But also, just like, why does Gallowglass leave? And why does Gallowglass believe that? Because clearly she's up to no good.
And he should have been able to sense Hubbard in there, right?
Right.
Don't they sense or smell and sense each other?
Or is that why she keeps him so far away? Like,
maybe.
He doesn't just drop her off. Like, she's still got a little bit of ways to go. And given that in the last episode, she literally wandered off with Kit. Like, Gallowglass, do not leave her alone. Like, don't do that.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, she's lost that, right?
Literally no lessons learned.
Yeah.
None.
From anyone.
No retention.
Correct. So they do that and...
short-term memory.
She goes to see Father Hubbard. So she's made arrangement. She wants Jack to be... And she says to Hubbard, if I'm your child, would you honor my request about Jack? And he says, if you offered me your blood. And she's like, sure.
And then she does the most complicated blood work that was so not necessary. Like, I get it. She's trying to show that she has power over. Look at how I can control my magic. But all she had to do was prick her stinking finger.
So she says it has to be done in a way that Matthew will never know about our pact. And he's like, done. Booyah. So he kneels. This is so funny. He kneels before her. She refuses his Barbie knife and opens a vein herself, which is totally smart.
I love it because you can see, like, you know that Hubbard's like, oh, I'm just going to take the one drop, but then her blood's going to be on the blade so I can have a little bit more later to get more information. And she's like, I've at least learned my lessons enough to know that I need to do this myself.
So he takes one drop and sees all the stuff.
Wasn't that just a really complicated way, though? Wouldn't it have been just quicker if she just, like, pricked her finger?
With what?
Because that could be easily explained. She could have had a needle on her. I mean, it's not uncommon. It's not an uncommon thing. She could have accidentally pricked her finger anywhere. What if her dress had a pin stuck in it? I've had dresses come back from alterations that have pins in them.
So, but the thing is, Hubbard hasn't seen her in a more powerful manifestation. Like, he saw her sort of comparatively meet earlier. So I think this is an important moment in establishing just how powerful she's become as she's come into her own magic, that she's able to not only cut her wrist and give, like, the tiniest drop of blood, but to get Hubbard
on his knees
on his knees because of the information. So I think this is just meant to establish Diana as powerful and as someone that Hubbard should fear, like every other de Clermont.
Unrelated, I'm super excited to see the character update made to Hubbard.
Yes, same.
To be modern. I can't wait to see the chin beard gone.
I hope they keep that actor. That's going to be nice.
They're going to keep that actor. He's no Baldwin. I can't wait to see what they do with his hair. Is he going to be like on par with Gerbert, or is he going to have, like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what he's going to look like without that weird puby beard.
So with Goody Alsop and Sophie, she says, I must leave even with only 9. And Goody Alsop gives her another knot, like shows her how to do another knot.
Does she show her?
Well, she tries. She cannot show her because she's not capable of it. So she can't actually do it, but she attempts to do it. And Diana sees how it is at least attemptable.
But what kills me about it is she's like, I'm going to try to do it. And then she goes, remember that. And I'm like, remember what? She didn't see you do it.
Remember how she tried. She saw her fingers move, and that's what's needed, not the done one. And the fact that she said remember it, or sorry, Diana says she will remember it. So she's got it. She just hasn't done it yet. So she tries to give her a knot, and she says a knot that is beginnings and endings. And she said she herself is not capable of it, but she did it, tried it for her so she could see how it was done, or at least attempted, formed, even though she couldn't complete it. And then she gives...
Yeah, but if somebody came up to me and said, I know how to knit, but I don't know how to do this one knit, but let me show you how it's done, but I can't show you how it's completed. It's not a really helpful...
But that's what she does in the book. She does, like, she shows her in the book, and the knot doesn't hold then either. I mean, that's coming from Shadow of Night. Yeah.
That's fine. It's still a weird thing to say and do, because it doesn't really show you how a thing is done anyway, because it's like, that would be like me saying, well, I know that when you knit, you have these two needles, and then you wrap the yarn around it, and then it's supposed to kind of, you know, when you do this with it, it does, like, it's a strange fascination to me. I'm like trying to understand.
But have we seen Goody Alsop actually show Diana any of the knots prior to this? It's usually just her, like, waving her hands in the air doing them. So the fact that we get Goody even showing her rather than just being like, yeah, you can do it, concentrate, is quite remarkable, I think, because this is the only time that we see her actually teaching rather than just sort of standing by.
So then Diana gives Sophie the silver Diana piece, and that's further.
She gives Susanna,
setting them up for the future so that they can make sure that they can get back.
You know, the only reason that she keeps that thing and passes it down is because she was such a bitch. And she's like, I'm sorry, I was such a bitch. So I'm gonna do what you ask because I need to make up for being such a bitch.
Present day Venice, Peter Knox and Satu are there looking at maps. And I believe it's maps of Satur, the ground surrounding it. And she offers to go to Satur to help him. And he's like, nah. And she says, your confidence will be your downfall.
What kind of map is it that it's got a spot that says, ooh, magical ruins?
Well, there are actually maps
that say magical ruins.
Well, not magical ruins, but they'll have the ruins in the landscape mark, ordnance surveys and stuff. And that's what it is. It's just an ordnance survey, but it'll say temple, and the witches will know that it's not just an old Roman temple in the French countryside, that it has the meaning. So maybe there are magical ordnance surveys.
Then we're taken back to Elizabeth London. Father Hubbard is sniffing.
Did you say the best line where he didn't need her pyrotechnics?
No, I didn't say that.
Because that was like, we don't need your pyrotech.
So I also didn't say that if you listen, because, and this is like most confirmation, I shouldn't probably have needed it, not to put myself up there, but I typically hear things. It just took me like a season and a half to even hear this thing. But the music that you hear here while they're there is that, I think you hear the da 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 da. That, like the weird, it's not the theme, but it's a theme, but it's not the main theme. But it's, you mostly hear the, like, it sounds like little tinkle tinkle in the background. Like,
sounds like somebody going to the bathroom.
It's the sound you hear when we first are introduced to Satu in Finland, when Nox goes to get her and all those things are hanging from trees. And we hear that. It sounds like
the wooden, like a wooden wind chime.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I call tinkle tinkle. Like little sounds of little things hanging from trees, making sounds. That is a witch's sound. It could be a bad witch's. We hear it with Nox and we hear it when he's with witches. We heard it in this scene, but we also hear it, I noticed earlier in this season, we also heard it with Diana around other witches. So it's definitely, it's a witch's sound. It's not a bad witch's sound. Could be an ominous sound, but it doesn't necessarily mean bad because we know Diana's not bad. She's a good witch. So Elizabeth in London, 1591, Father Hubbard is sniffing something out, huh? Or is he, or someone out, who knows? He comes across Benjamin Fuchs. Wow. And Benjamin says, who is that witch you met? Nanya. And he's like, that is no way to speak to your sire.
I love this middle of the road bombshell drop. Like,
right.
Right? Defoe?
The last minute. And the thing, and that's like the way the whole rest of the episode goes.
Yeah.
It's just drop, 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 drop. But save all of it. You're going to need it later.
This is such an important revelation and sets up so much for Book of Life that I'm like, could we not have had Fuchs a little bit more? Like, I need more of him because he's super creepy in this episode.
Oh, I think he's going to be like the star of season three.
Yeah.
The gross star, the big baddie of season three.
Well, he's not just the big baddie of season three. He's the big baddie of everything.
He's the baddie of the trilogy.
Yeah.
Whom you don't really get to know but until book three.
Right? Which is fine. And it works in the books. But I'm really curious as to how he's going to come off in season three. Because, like, they can't not use him in season three. But it's just, like, we've had such quick scenes. And in a way, yes, it's like the books. They're quick scenes. But there's more in the book. And it's subtle. But I wanted more of him so that when we get to him in season three, we understand the danger and we understand that everyone who has interacted with him so far knows there's something not quite right, but no one really knows the full impact. So I wanted more hints of that throughout the season. And so sort of seeing him again in 10 is almost this like, oh yeah, we've got to remind you that he's really important. So we're just going to have this little scene amongst all of our other little scenes that tell you this.
We threw him away in that last episode when we could have highlighted him more. So now we're going to give you just another taste to remind you that you need to remember who this person is.
But we're also going to like confuse Hubbard as well in this process, which fine, whatever.
Oxford, present day. Domenico confronts a dude who is the dude who's the killer of all the people, and he confronts him and says, I know you are the one to take the portraits, and it's something to do with Matthew and Diana. Show me who you are. He attacks him. Sex on legs is left on the floor. He gets himself up and onto a couch, but he's not doing great.
Do we think, because they didn't announce who they cast as this character yet, before while they were filming, do you think they had that person already, or did they just have some dude in a hoodie?
I thought they had announced it.
I don't think, they didn't announce him until after. He was part of the announcements that came as it started airing. When they announced Fernando, they announced Jack again, they announced somebody else. There was at least another person. There was at least three.
Wait, that was like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
I know. That's what I'm saying. They just announced him, who's playing Elder Jack.
A, what is this character listed as in the credits? I haven't checked. And B,
dude in a hoodie.
Is it
Blood Ragey? I don't know. Let me see.
Is it the same person? Like, because I think that's a good point that they could very well have done this without you seeing.
Which is why the hoodie, because if you have, it covers his face.
Book readers know who it is. There are non-book readers, and mm-hmm. I've seen some conversation trying to figure out who the killer is. And some people have guessed correctly, right? And some people are like, I'm not sure. I think it's even clear to book readers that this figure is connected to Matthew and Diana. And it's even, to me, it's very obvious that it's someone very important to Matthew and Diana, because he attacks after Domenico says, oh, this is about Matthew and Diana. He does it just like attack because he stole the portraits. He attacked because there's an implied threat.
I'm looking at IMDb and it looks like it's potentially uncredited.
So we find out that they are going to walk that night. They say they need to time walk to Set Tour that night. So they give the book to Galaglass to take to Dr. D. Hugs and kisses, Gigi.
This is becoming just like the last episode of last season, which is the long goodbye. And they're going to do this again. I guarantee you it's going to happen all over again next season because it's the long goodbye to this series.
Diana says, very touchingly, keep the other Matthew safe for me so he can find me one day. And Galaglass says, I've got some mopping up to do. And then it's the gorgeous theme. Matthew says, goodbye, nephew.
Aww.
Poor Jack does not want to go.
This is like the worst. This is the reason they should never have really taken up with him in the first place, because they knew they were leaving. They were always leaving.
Or they should have, if they wanted to rescue him, they should have placed him with Percy from day one.
Exactly.
I think very quickly we're attached to him, and Matthew most reluctantly. And it sort of, there was no going back once that attachment had formed.
Which is the same reason why you should not have adopted a dog in the pandemic that you were not prepared to care for post-pandemic.
Present day Satur. Knox arrives in his big black vehicle, ready to do some deeds. Then present day London. Domenico struts. He's going to do some damage. And we see a modern day Fuchs back at Satur. Knox is at the temple outside Satur. He sees the remnants of past magic.
She does not clean up after herself. I thought better of Emily. I thought Emily would have cleaned up after herself. Who would leave? Like, she left burnt candle ends and whatever else just on the ground. Like, she's littering. She littered and left all of the evidence of her magical things. I don't think that that is something that you would do. It's outside of Septur grounds.
But it's outside of Septur grounds, but it's still on De Clermont lands.
Correct.
So I think she...
He's still trespassing.
But I think this is the thing. Like, she leaves it because she thinks it's safe.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot here that I think is problematic in terms of boundaries and that they kind of address, but only obliquely.
Using his magic eight ball without the answering ability, his witch's ball, he does his spell.
He's playing with his ball.
He draws the people who are connected to it, meaning that little magic spot, from their slumber. M wakes up and obeys. And as she's getting up and walking out, we hear the baby witch crying. I'm kind of surprised that the baby witch is that sensitive, but Sarah is not.
She got up and out of bed and up and out of that house without showing any sign that she had any items with her, but was able to get all the way to the ruin and set up a whole nother seance.
Because she left her materials.
Sarah wakes up. We don't know. It looks like not too long after, but long enough because bitch is already set up at the place. So Sarah wakes up, finds her gone, and gets up with the demons. Now no one knows where M is. Of course she's at the temple ruins. And she's got the page, right? The page is there in the middle. She's calling Rebecca. And they take hands. And Rebecca says, I can't help you. And Rebecca says, there will be dark times and great losses, but the book will change everything once it's completed. The book will reveal itself. And she asks, how do we complete it? And then she pulls her hands away, or they stop holding hands. And she says, you're in danger. He wants the page.
Do you think that Peter being present and the power that he had used at that spot influenced her actually being to successfully talk to Rebecca?
No.
Because she has not successfully been able to really talk to Rebecca. Like, Rebecca was not this chatty. Even the last time, she only really said two words. I mean, granted, Sarah did stand up and ruin the whole thing by stepping into the circle, but...
Both times we've seen him try prior to this, Sarah has ruined the moment. Like, she's interrupted and broken the concentration. So I think that really it's not Knox's extra power. It's just that Knox is slightly more patient than Sarah. But even then, he approaches because he's like, ooh, it's Rebecca. And we all know he has an unhealthy thing for Rebecca.
Correct.
And so, as I said, the magic ends. M sees.
So, wait. Rebecca gives M all of this information, which is going to now die with her.
No, except, well, not that it helps others, but Peter hears it. So it doesn't technically die with her, but for all intents and purposes, to the good side, it does. So the magic ends. M sees Knox, and she thank the baby Jeebus. She disappears the page before he can get it. And how do we know that? Besides seeing it, he commands her to bring it back, and she refuses. And he kills her.
Well, and the thing is, so we don't really know what happened in the books, what happened in this moment.
No.
And I think it's really interesting that what he's trying to do is not get information about Matthew or Diana, but to get the page, to get that folio. And it's sort of, to me, that it's sort of, M dies for the book. She's another creature that dies to protect or to make or to find out information about this manuscript, not anything else, right? And I just think that that's really interesting, the amount of death associated with the manuscript.
Physically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I love that they kind of let M have her little shiny moment. Now, granted, book readers know that it's nice to be able to see her protecting Diana to the end.
So Diana
will avenge me dead.
He kills her, but not before she says, Diana will unite all creatures against Spigot like you, and she will avenge me. And then she dies. Like, well, she knows she's dead. She knows she's dead. And then Nox gets up, gets out of Dodge.
Well, because she knows. She's like, I'm not going to give you what you want. And if I don't give you what you want, you're going to kill me. And you're going to kill me anyway.
So Nox tries to get out of Dodge, but Marcus finds him. Marcus has gone out, but Marcus gets nothing.
Did anyone else get some like serious like Twilight Edward energy from him standing in the forest and you're on my land?
Not until you just said it, but yes, the way he's kind of hunched down-ish. Yes. Nox says, young bucks should never break from the herd. Now you pay the price. And he hears the others coming and then he gets going. And Marcus is like, don't start this war. You don't want this. You don't want this. He's like, okay, fine. Just sleep. And then he knocks him out. And that's how you end a season of A Discovery of Witches, by letting us see what is going on in present time. Now, I understand it's a completely different medium. This is no shade toward anything, because opening up, and this is not really a spoiler anymore because you just saw it happen, but opening up book three for readers like kills us, because we don't know until book three, you know, a little tiny bit into book three, that M is dead. And we find out right away that she's dead, but we don't know what happened.
I think we kind of glazed over this, but Sarah comes downstairs before that whole thing happens, the baby that you heard crying before, little witchy Margaret, is crying, and they're like, we're sorry, we don't know what she's upset about, because little baby Margaret heard the spell. Little baby Margaret was taken out of her sleep by Peter Nox. And then the minute that she knows she's gone, Sarah's like, I know where she went. And she goes out. Sarah is the one who finds her.
That was rough. Whew. Enough about that, because that'll bring a tear prick. Talk about penultimate. Here's the penultimate. London, 1591. Still drawing out their goodbyes. Endings and beginnings. Let's get hoppin'. But first, we need to get naked, at least 16th century naked. And then they say, let's go meet our future. And they close their door so they can get naked. And then present time, we see Gerbert. We see, again, montage, right? We see Gerbert running off. We see Sarah still holding M, Agatha with her granddaughter, Marcus on the ground sleeping, and Isabeau is holding up a medal of Philippe's. And all of that is like, oh, the dude's getting away. M is dead. So it's like, okay, scariness for Gerbert. He represents bad things. Sadness and destruction, you know, seeing that, you know, M is dead. And then with Agatha and her granddaughter, it's the hope in the future, and the hope for the future, and also fear for the future. Marcus sleeping, sad. You know, he's not dead, but what's going to happen? What did he see? How did he, is he okay?
They have to leave everyone in peril so that everyone tunes in next year.
Correct. But Isabeau holding up Philippe's medal, I argue that's not peril. That is the one thing I hope we got for us for the next season. Her holding up that medal is a sign or foreshadowing, not even foreshadowing. It is hope that there is a battle to come.
Well, not just that, but the big sort of comparison between the end of season one and season two, where it's like the start of chaos at the end of season one, and then season two just ends in complete chaos. And I like that sort of juxtaposition of like, oh, we're just going to go back in time to learn some magic so that we can fight the war. And then season two's like, so there's a war, and tune in, and like whenever you want, we'll tell you what happens.
So if you want to know what happens next, either wait until 2022, because that's when it's going to be back. They have not listed a month yet. What day it's going to be out. But sometime in 2022, they will bring back with season three, which they've already finished filming. So that's good. Or if you can't wait, there's always the book. And that's the good thing about adaptation. Even if we don't agree with all of the adaptive choices, the book's still there and we can always read it and get back to the thing that we loved the most, which is the book, which started it all.
And we hope to be able to, yes, finally, eventually get back to our Discovery of Witches read-along so that we can get to a Shadow of Night read-along. Now, if that all will be done, we can promise you we won't get Book of Life done before season three, but we will do our darndest to do a read-along in some capacity. It'll be chapter by chapter, but maybe not one chapter per episode, right? So we will chat about it. It might not be in as much detail as we've done before, but we are committed to getting the books discussed. Thank you guys as always. Thank you, Summer. Thank you, Stephanie, Dr. Steph.
Thank you, Dr. Stephanie.
Thank you, guys.
And for joining us here. And thank you, Ginger. You're welcome, Ginger. Thank you guys almost.
Almost? Don't fully thank me. Just almost thank me.
No!
Just almost thank
almost.
Me. Just almost.
Thank you guys as always. You have to keep that in now. So much for listening. We look forward to our next episode in which...
And a next season, whenever it comes.
And a next season. Thank you so much, and we can't wait for season three.